Chapter 12. Girl with long bleached tresses and a rather sour face. His legs were much swollen, and he could hardly walk. Carlier, undermined by fever, could not swagger anymore, but kept tottering about, still with a devil-may-care air, as became a man who remembered his crack regiment. He had become hoarse, sarcastic, and inclined to say unpleasant things. He called it Ain't Frank With You. They had long ago reckoned their percentages on trade, including in them that last deal of his infamous Macola. They had also concluded not to say anything about it. Kurtz hesitated at first, was afraid of the director. He has seen worse things done on the quiet, maintained Carlier, with a hoarse laugh. T trust him. He won't thank you if you blab. He is no better than you or me. Who will talk, if we hold our tongues? There is nobody here. That was the root of the trouble. There was nobody there, and being left there alone with their weakness, they became daily more like a pair of accomplices than like a couple of devoted friends. They had heard nothing from home for 8 months. Every evening they said, "Tomorrow we shall see the steamer." But one of the company's steamers had been wrecked, and the director was busy with the other, relieving very distant and important stations on the main river. He thought that the useless station, and the useless men, could wait. Meantime, Kurtz and Carlier lived on rice boiled without salt, and cursed the company, all Africa, and the day they were born. One must have lived on such diet, to discover what ghastly trouble the necessity of swallowing one's food may become. There was literally nothing else in the station, but rice and coffee. They drank the coffee without sugar. The last 15 lumps Kurtz had solemnly locked away in his box, together with a half bottle of cognac, in case of sickness, he explained. Carlier approved. When one is sick, he said, any little extra like that is cheering. They waited. Rank grass began to sprout over the courtyard. The bell never rang now. Days passed, silent, exasperating, and slow. When the two men spoke, they snarled, and their silences were bitter, as if tinged by the bitterness of their thoughts. One day after a lunch of boiled rice, Carlier put down his cup untasted, and said, hang it all. Let's have a decent cup of coffee for once. Bring out that sugar, Kurtz. For the sick, muttered Kurtz, without looking up. For the sick, mocked Carlier. Be bosh, well. I am sick. You are no more sick than I am, and I go without, said Kurtz in a peaceful tone. Come, out with that sugar, you stingy old slave dealer. Kurtz looked up quickly. Carlier was smiling with marked insolence. And suddenly it seemed to Kurtz that he had never seen that man before. Who was he? He knew nothing about him. What was he capable of? There was a surprising flash of violent emotion within him, as if in the presence of something undreamt of, dangerous, and final. But he managed to pronounce with composure, that joke is in very bad taste. Don't repeat it. Joke, said Carlier, hitching himself forward on his seat. I am hungry, I am sick, I don't joke. I hate hypocrites. You are a hypocrite. You are a slave dealer. I am a slave dealer. There's nothing but slave dealers in this cursed country. I mean to have sugar in my coffee today, anyhow. I forbid you to speak to me in that way, said Kurtz with a fair show of resolution. You? What? Shouted Carlier, jumping up. Kurtz stood up also. I am your chief, he began, trying to master the shakiness of his voice. What? Yelled the other. Who's chief? There's no chief here. There's nothing here. There's nothing but you and one. Fetch the sugar, you pot-bellied ass. Hold your tongue. Go out of this room, screamed Kurtz. I dismiss you, you scoundrel. Carlier swung a stool. All at once he looked dangerously in earnest. You flabby, good-for-nothing civilian, take that, he howled. Kurtz dropped under the table, and the stool struck the grass inner wall of the room. Then, as Carlier was trying to upset the table, Kurtz in desperation made a blind rush, head low, like a cornered pig would do, and overturning his friend, bolted along the veranda and into his room. He locked the door, snatched his revolver, and stood panting. In less than a minute, Carlier was kicking at the door furiously, howling, "If you don't bring out that sugar, I will shoot you at sight, like a dog. Now then, 1, 2, 3. You won't? I will show you who's the master." Kurtz thought the door would fall in, and scrambled through the square hole that served for a window in his room. There was then the whole breadth of the house between them. But the other was apparently not strong enough to break in the door, and Kurtz heard him running round. Then he also began to run laboriously on his swollen legs. He ran as quickly as he could, grasping the revolver, and unable yet to understand what was happening to him. He saw in succession McCullough's house, the store, the river, the ravine, and the low bushes, and he saw all those things again as he ran for the second time round the house. Then again they flashed past him. That morning he could not have walked a yard without a groan. And now he ran. He ran fast enough to keep out of sight of the other man. Then as, weak and desperate, he thought, "Before I finish the next round I shall die," he heard the other man stumble heavily, then stop. He stopped also. He had the back and Carlier the front of the house, as before. He heard him drop into a chair cursing, and suddenly his own legs gave way, and he slid down into a sitting posture with his back to the wall. His mouth was as dry as a cinder, and his face was wet with perspiration and tears. What was it all about? He thought it must be a horrible illusion. He thought he was dreaming. He thought he was going mad. After a while he collected his senses. What did they quarrel about? That sugar. How absurd. He would give it to him, didn't want it himself. And he began scrambling to his feet with a sudden feeling of security. But before he had fairly stood upright, a common sense reflection occurred to him, and drove him back into despair. He thought, "Colin, if I give way now to that brute of a soldier, he will begin this horror again tomorrow, and the day after every day raise other pretensions, trample on me, torture me, make me his slave, and I will be lost. Lost. The steamer may not come for days, may never come." He shook so that he had to sit down on the floor again. He shivered forlornly. He felt he could not, would not move anymore. He was completely distracted by the sudden perception that the position was without issue, that death and life had in a moment become equally difficult and terrible. All at once he heard the other push his chair back, and he leaped to his feet with extreme facility. He listened and got confused. Must run again. Right or left? He heard footsteps. He darted to the left, grasping his revolver, and at the very same instant, as it seemed to him, they came into violent collision. Both shouted with surprise. A loud explosion took place between them, a roar of red fire, thick smoke, and Kurtz, deafened and blinded, rushed back thinking, "Colin, I am hit, it's all over." He expected the other to come round, to gloat over his agony. He caught hold of an upright of the roof, fell over. Then he heard a crashing fall on the other side of the house, as if somebody had tumbled headlong over a chair, then silence. Nothing more happened. He did not die. Only his shoulder felt as if it had been badly wrenched, and he had lost his revolver. He was disarmed and helpless. He waited for his fate. The other man made no sound. It was a stratagem. He was stalking him now. Along what side? Perhaps he was taking aim this very minute. After a few moments of an agony frightful and absurd, he decided to go and meet his doom. He was prepared for every surrender. He turned the corner, steadying himself with one hand on the wall, made a few paces, and nearly swooned. He had seen on the floor, protruding past the other corner, a pair of turned-up feet. A pair of white naked feet in red slippers. He felt deadly sick, and stood for a time in profound darkness. Then McCullough appeared before him, saying quietly, "Colin, come along, Mr. Kurtz. He is dead. He burst into tears of gratitude, a loud, sobbing fit of crying. After a time he found himself sitting in a chair and looking at Carlier, who lay stretched on his back. McCullough was kneeling over the body. "Is this your revolver?" asked McCullough, getting up. "Yes," said Kearse. Then he added very quickly, "He ran after me to shoot me, you saw." "Yes, I saw," said McCullough. "T, there is only one revolver. Where's his?" "Don't know," whispered Kearse in a voice that had become suddenly very faint. "I will go and look for it," said the other, gently. He made the round along the veranda, while Kearse sat still and looked at the corpse. McCullough came back empty-handed, stood in deep thought, then stepped quietly into the dead man's room, and came out directly with a revolver, which he held up before Kearse. Kearse shut his eyes. Everything was going round. He found life more terrible and difficult than death. He had shot an unarmed man. After meditating for a while, McCullough said softly, pointing at the dead man who lay there with his right eye blown out, "He died of fever." Kearse looked at him with a stony stare. "Yes," repeated McCullough, thoughtfully, stepping over the corpse, "I think he died of fever. Bury him tomorrow." And he went away slowly to his expectant wife, leaving the two white men alone on the veranda. Night came, and Kearse sat unmoving on his chair. He sat quiet, as if he had taken a dose of opium. The violence of the emotions he had passed through produced a feeling of exhausted serenity. He had plumbed in one short afternoon the depths of horror and despair, and now found repose in the conviction that life had no more secrets for him. Neither had death. He sat by the corpse thinking, thinking very actively, thinking very new thoughts. He seemed to have broken loose from himself altogether. His old thoughts, convictions, likes and dislikes, things he respected, and things he abhorred, appeared in their true light at last. Appeared contemptible and childish, false and ridiculous. He reveled in his new wisdom, while he sat by the man he had killed. He argued with himself about all things under heaven with that kind of wrong-headed lucidity which may be observed in some lunatics. Incidentally, he reflected that the fellow dead there had been a noxious beast anyway, that men died every day in thousands, perhaps in hundreds of thousands, who could tell? And that in the number, that one death could not possibly make any difference, couldn't have any importance, at least to a thinking creature. He, Kearse, was a thinking creature. He had been all his life, till that moment, a believer in a lot of nonsense like the rest of mankind who are fools. But now he thought. He knew. He was at peace. He was familiar with the highest wisdom. Then he tried to imagine himself dead, and Carlier sitting in his chair watching him. And his attempt met with such unexpected success, that in a very few moments he became not at all sure who was dead, and who was alive. This extraordinary achievement of his fancy startled him, however, and by a clever and timely effort of mind he saved himself just in time from becoming Carlier. His heart thumped, and he felt hot all over at the thought of that danger. Carlier! What a beastly thing! To compose his now disturbed nerves, and no wonder, he tried to whistle a little. Then, suddenly, he fell asleep, or thought he had slept, but at any rate there was a fog, and somebody had whistled in the fog. He stood up. The day had come, and a heavy mist had descended upon the land. The mist penetrating, enveloping, and silent, the morning mist of tropical lands, the mist that clings and kills. The mist white and deadly, immaculate and poisonous. He stood up, saw the body, and threw his arms above his head with a cry like that of a man who, waking from a trance, finds himself immured forever in a tomb. Help! My God! A shriek inhuman, vibrating and sudden, pierced like a sharp dart the white shroud of that land of sorrow. Three short, impatient screeches followed, and then, for a time, the fog wreaths rolled on, undisturbed, through a formidable silence. Then many more shrieks, rapid and piercing, like the yells of some exasperated and ruthless creature, rent the air. Progress was calling to Kaertz from the river. Progress and civilization and all the virtues. Society was calling to its accomplished child to come, to be taken care of, to be instructed, to be judged, to be condemned. It called him to return to that rubbish heap from which he had wandered away, so that justice could be done. Kaertz heard and understood. He stumbled out of the veranda, leaving the other man quite alone for the first time since they had been thrown there together. He groped his way through the fog, calling in his ignorance upon the invisible heaven to undo its work. Makola flitted by in the mist, shouting as he ran, "Steamer! Steamer! They can't see. They whistle for the station. I go ring the bell. Go down to the landing, sir. I ring." He disappeared. Kaertz stood still. He looked upwards. The fog rolled low over his head. He looked round like a man who has lost his way, and he saw a dark smudge, a cross-shaped stain, upon the shifting purity of the mist. As he began to stumble towards it, the station bell rang in a tumultuous peal its answer to the impatient clamor of the steamer. The managing director of the great civilizing company, since we know that civilization follows trade, landed first, and incontinently lost sight of the steamer. The fog down by the river was exceedingly dense. Above, at the station, the bell rang unceasing and brazen. The director shouted loudly to the steamer. "There is nobody down to meet us. There may be something wrong, though they are ringing. You had better come to." And he began to toil up the steep bank. The captain and the engine driver of the boat followed behind. As they scrambled up, the fog thinned, and they could see their director a good way ahead. Suddenly they saw him start forward, calling to them over his shoulder. Run to the house. I found one of them. Run, look for the other." He had found one of them. And even he, the man of varied and startling experience, was somewhat discomposed by the manner of this finding. He stood and fumbled in his pockets for a knife, while he faced Kaertz, who was hanging by a leather strap from the cross. He had evidently climbed the grave, which was high and narrow, and after tying the end of the strap to the arm, had swung himself off. His toes were only a couple of inches above the ground. His arms hung stiffly down. He seemed to be standing rigidly at attention, but with one purple cheek playfully posed on the shoulder. And, irreverently, he was putting out a swollen tongue at his managing director. The return, the inner circle train from the city rushed impetuously out of a black hole, and pulled up with a discordant, grinding racket in the smirched twilight of a West End station. A line of doors flew open, and a lot of men stepped out headlong. They had high hats, healthy pale faces, dark overcoats and shiny boots. They held in their gloved hands thin umbrellas, and hastily folded evening papers that resembled stiff, dirty rags of greenish, pinkish, or whitish color. Alvin Hervey stepped out with the rest, a smoldering cigar between his teeth. A disregarded little woman in rusty black, with both arms full of parcels, ran along in distress, bolted suddenly into a third-class compartment, and the train went on. The slamming of carriage doors. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.